When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
No. No, man. No, man. I believe you get your ass kicked saying something like that, man.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
The f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Greg Pappas on the board. Matt Weber should be here pretty soon, as soon as he makes his way through Chicago traffic. S&P futures up 78. NASDAQ futures up 329. This rally kind of started Friday afternoon late. Sort of out of the blue, and I'm being this conspiracy theorist that I guess I'm turning into. I'm like, boy, what are the people in Washington front running again? And sure enough, Saturday morning, they cut back on a lot of the tariffs, cell phones and other kinds of stuff. And if anybody can tell you where the tariffs stand right now, he's a smart man, because they're all over the place. And as Elizabeth Warren, I'm not too fond of quoting, everybody who gives a guy $1 million gets the tariffs pulled back on them. I don't think I've ever seen as much front-running in my life, what appears to be anyway.
Apple's up 6%, NVIDIA yeah. up 3%.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about serious stuff here. And, you know, and the funny part is I've talked to a few people that are, you know, staunch Republicans over the weekend, and they're like, yeah, what about Pelosi? Like, Pelosi's almost dead. Leave her alone. That has nothing to do with this week. Yeah, but what about Pelosi? Now,
I wonder actually how she is doing.
I don't know. I bet we could find out.
Yeah. The Pelosi tracker.
I would say that she's probably not even the top 10 in Congress of people that are trading this stuff.
Oh, no. She's always top 10. She's.
I'm saying right now.
Bad for her would be like, you know, top 5 or 5.
You think she has none of this stuff going on in the last 5 weeks, which is more than I've ever seen. When's the last time you saw how many 3% moves we have? 3% move is not healthy, even in a good market. Today we're only 1.7 so far, right?
Yeah, it's only, that's it. So far, well, she did a lot of trading last year. I'm seeing.
But that justifies everything these guys do, though, because Pelosi could be.
No, I think, what's it called? Cantor Fitzgerald is probably going to be the best performing firm ever.
Yeah.
In the next.
Well, what about, I still think the lady who walked out of the meeting and sold all
give
her
me
stocks
a sec on
before
this one.
They got the COVID stuff is bizarre. The pretty interesting stuff, but hey, I had a chance this weekend. She's been on the show a couple of times. Lady that's doing the stuff on Fisher House, Diane Kelly. She's been on the show a couple times about and she works a lot for the Veterans Home. They have a Fisher House at the. To go back to this, Fisher House is like the Ronald McDonald of veterans facilities. If people have to come to a veterans home for whatever reason, the family can stay at Fisher House for free, much like if you have a problem in some, like at one of the children's hospitals, the family can stay at a Ronald McDonald House. And it's an amazing idea and great work on both people. I actually knew the guy, he's no longer alive, who was one of the people who put together the Ronald McDonald House. His name was Chuck Eberling. Real nice guy. And he was one of the, I don't know if he was the money behind it or whatever, but he was the person at McDonald's who kind of was in charge of, or was certainly involved, I won't say in charge, of putting that whole thing together. But So Diane does that for the Chicago area Fisher houses. And they have the one at Heinz, the big facility over here in Maywood. And they have the one at their building that she was talking about up by Great Lakes. Two totally different sort of groups of people. When I say that, the one up at Great Lakes is kind of is going to be designed sort of a lot of people that are currently in the, because Great Lakes is still probably this, I think it's the only, for lack of a better term, boot camp for the Navy. So there's an awful lot of people at Great Lakes that are in the Navy. And in, I don't know if they have other, probably have Marines up there as well, I don't know that. So if people get injured while they're actually in service, that place up there is designed to take care of those people as well. Where the one over on the west side, Heinz, is just for, and I, you know, as we talk about, you know, care and the veterans facilities and people and budget cuts and, you know, I'm not saying that there's no waste places and you can't do something more. All I know is that the amount of volunteers that work at these places is pretty high. Get a load of this, Greg. She could use your expertise, although she's pretty good at it. She personally is cooking for 30 people Easter morning up at Outer Heights.
Nice.
Yeah. And
lucky them.
Yeah. Well, oh, yeah. And every Sunday, she goes there at 5 o'clock because they have a mass and she serves communion and stuff. She's a devout Catholic. And we had brunch yesterday and I had a chance to talk to her for a while, which is always a treat, by the way. Talk about a terrific lady. She's also a sommelier. So I bet you're not one of those.
Not me. I haven't done those tests, but we do know a bunch who have, and it's the real deal.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, and some people just can't do it. They're not, some people have no, they can't carry a tune. Some people can't just taste the same things. It's interesting because it's a vocabulary that you need to become familiar with, even if you can make the distinctions. You have to be able to describe them, which is a skill in itself. So watching people study and take those tests is, you know, it's very entertaining.
Well, you have to have an amazing sense of smell, for sure.
Yeah, smell and taste are very similar, and then again, the vocabulary to be able to separate what you're tasting, because you can taste the difference, but then you might be able to differentiate, but then you can't describe it the right way, and then you fail like that.
Yeah, it's
because you could be right. It's like labeling a chord, you know, A7 or something, but you can say it's A major diminished or something. You can mess it up, and if you mess up the label part, even though you're, yeah,
it's quite the skill. I mean, you
might be able to play it.
Let's just say Moet would hire her tomorrow. She handled the Moet account at Southern Beverage.
Yeah,
and Moet absolutely. Anyway, I did, you know, you forget these things, but I was asking her who the veterans home takes care of over in Maywood. And everyone kind of has their shtick, I guess. If you have any kind of burn issues, you're sent to the veterans home, Texas. I assume it's in Dallas, but I don't know. Maybe it's in Houston. But the one here does a lot of the eye issues, a lot of the cancer issues, a lot of the... what do you call when you have the limbs that aren't your own?
Prosthetics?
Yeah, they do a lot of that. But I was stunned. I said, who's the biggest stayers in the Fisher House? She said, it's mostly people. Well, she said, of course, they have their people that are 95 and 100. They're just never leaving. They've got that whole couple of wings. But I was stunned. I mean, I guess, you know, and I shouldn't be. I mean, talk about somebody should kick you in the ass. She says the amount of chemotherapy, the amount of cancer patients they have from the Vietnam era, with most people applying most of it to Agent Orange and things like that, is dramatic. People come from downstate or someplace up here and they do their chemo routine for a week or two. The family stays at Fisher House and then they leave for a couple of months and come back for another round. And so the incidence of that is off the chart. You know, I guess I should have been smart enough to realize that, but boy, considering that was my era, that's interesting, huh?
Having seen that here and been to the chemo ward at here, you know, what, a mile away or whatever, not the place I would pick.
No.
I'm sure all the medicine is right, but it's not, doesn't quite look as nice as the other places. Doesn't seem as organized. I don't know how you really do that without adjusting the care.
Yeah, I mean, it's my mom was did chemo while at Northwestern, and the people there were spectacular. This a long time ago, and you know, what's weird about it is, if you've ever never been in the chemo wards, are designed to be very, very comfortable. So people are getting their chemo in big, huge, easy chairs, and they have chess boards, they have games, they have all kinds of stuff, because you're there sometimes on that stuff for hours. I mean, every different cancer, every different chemo is different. To label them with one name is, you know, I foolishly used to do that. But you know what's the oddest? This is all the nurses in there, or I guess their assistants. Somebody, I was sitting there with my mom, and all of a sudden, nobody's even looking. And somebody walks in the door with this big 5-pound thing of Fannie Mae. I don't know if they could tell by the sound, the box hitting the counter. Every one of the nurses kind of gets up and wanders over toward the counter. Of course, they brought some back for every, because you're encouraged to eat and stuff while you're there. So if people bring in pounds of, you know, 5-pound box of candy, you pass it around to all the people that are out, that have the chemo thing stuck in them.
Yeah, Northwestern's kind of like San Diego, and I'd say the VA is like, I don't know, Antarctica. It's pretty different.
Yeah, but I, you know, well, she said the biggest thing is all these, except for the people who, you know, have their family comes and stays at Fisher House, the rest of the people, they have nobody. Nobody ever shows up. I, when my stepfather was down in Manteno, which is a state-run, actually, I'd like to get Diana someday to explain the difference between who knows what where. It's a state-run veterans facility, and it took us months to get my stepfather in there instead of out of a nursing home. And there's a big, long waiting list, right? And it's, that time it was like 6 months. Well, of course, a significant percentage of the people croak while they're on the waiting list, right? So when you get there, I'm wandering around, and the rooms are totally like half full. And I said, well, why is there a waiting list when the place is half full? And they say, well, gee, we don't have enough staff. But the people there were absolutely spectacular. I mean, it's like in the Kankakee area, and wherever they get the people that work there, talk about people that give a crap. I mean, I was never more impressed with the people in a place in my life than that place.
Well, that's kind of good to know, and that if that's state-run and nursing homes are overwhelmingly private, then, yeah, how about that?
No question. It was better than any nursing home that he was in.
Wow.
No question. And you know, they have these people's pictures on the wall when they were, you know, 19 and a total stud in the Army and stuff, so people, you know, have a feeling for what these guys did. And they've got the commissary, they got a little bank in there, they got everything. And, you know, it's, you know, but he was in a wing where, you know, the guys there weren't doing much. But they were always, you know, the phone system had to be from the 40s. TVs were from, you know, God knows when. But, you know, I said to the guy, my brother dropped him off, and we had a dealer, Dan lives on the south side, and he would go two nights a week, and I would go on Saturday. So he had a visitor 3 days a week. And I get the feeling, I'm looking around going, God, none of these other guys got visitors. And one morning, Audrey and I brought her little pooch that no longer with us, what was the dog's name? She was one of those Japanese chins, and she loved everybody. And we brought, and these guys was a ward, it wasn't an Alzheimer's ward, but these guys had real serious circulation problems, you know, like mentally and so forth. Guys just sit there in their wheelchairs and spin around. They'd have a John Wayne movie on, I'd be the only guy watching, right? Everybody else is like, God knows what they're doing. Well, as soon as Rosie came in, the little chin, everybody's eyes lit up. She's on everybody's lap. She was the biggest hit of the week for the place.
Wow.
They wouldn't care if you brought a dog in, everybody's eyes lit up. Everybody's eyes lit up. If a friendly dog was over, all of a sudden these guys, they're sitting in damn near a coma. They're all of a sudden they're alive, they're petting the dog. It's amazing what animals can do for people. And of course, Rosie loved it. I mean, she was a little piece of shit that day. Talk about stubborn. But she was the greatest little pooch. And these guys, we're talking about attitude. Those little Japanese chins. Anyway, so I said to the guy, how come you made, my stepfather's name is Walter, how come you made Walter sign like all these papers, and the papers are like, who's, you know, what Undertaker do we call, you know, that kind of thing. And I go, how the hell, why do you do that? And he goes, this time let me help you. You and your brother are very unusual. These people drop their dead off, they don't see him until they see the body in the funeral home. They don't, assuming they're not cremated. He goes, they never come back. They drop them off with the intention of never coming back, and they never do.
Ugh.
They have had a thing where, this is an interesting
That's
story.
That's one way to treat family.
Oh, yeah. So we had an interesting story. He's in there for a while, and all of a sudden, I get this letter, because I'm the older one, and I get this letter, and it says something about Tuesday morning, we're having a review of Walter's stuff at 10 o'clock. So I say to Dan, what do you think? And he goes, well, I'll cover us here. You go. All right, so I drive all the way down to Mantino, and I walk in. There's a room number on it, and I'm walking around, and I find the room, and I'm standing out in the hallway like some geek, and all of a sudden, people in the room are looking at me like I got three heads. All of a sudden, one lady walks out, and she goes, can we help you?
Who are you?
Yeah, she says, can we help you? And I said, I got this letter. She goes, oh, come on in. I sit down, and everybody's staring at me. I thought I had like some, I just grew two zits or something on the way down there. And, you know, a lot of work.
You're kind of hard to miss.
I know, kind of attractive ladies. I said, okay, I'll start. Am I not supposed to be here? And I could tell by the body language, am I not supposed to be here? And one lady goes, no, you're supposed to be here. She goes, we've been doing these things for 7 years. You're the first person who's ever shown up.
Wow.
I go, you got to be kidding me. She goes, no. She goes, but yeah, you're supposed to be here. Matter of fact, let's do what we're supposed to do. And they went around the table. They had the dietitian saying how much he was eating, if he was gaining weight. They had somebody else, how's the therapy going? They had a big powwow, six people, and every one of them doing their part for my stepfather. And I walked out, and the lady goes, we still can't believe you showed up.
You showed up.
I mean, that's, how scary is that, Greg? This is family for guys. He was a stepfather. He wasn't even my father, but he's still family.
Yeah, that's kind of scary to hear that a lot of people don't show up. Not surprising, but you know, you'd like to get that percentage up.
Yeah, I know it's. So I had one of my friends who ended up not making it. A guy who was and this is, I don't really talk about this maybe too much maybe today, but to me it's kind of near and dear because the Vietnam era. I knew all these, not all, I knew some of these people that didn't come back, and I knew a lot that came back and were just not whole. And this guy, whose name was Al, he ended up being a bartender across the street from near my house. But he was a guy, he put signs up on the highway. He also was like the best dart champion in the whole neighborhood. Everyone wanted him on his team, but he was just a guy who never could quite make it back. He did two or three tours. He came back. All the girls he knew were married. All the guys he knew would move, you know, that kind of thing. Never really made it back in society. Terrific guy. Wore the typical, the knit hat, the goatee, and the green jacket, the green fatigue jacket, basically the Vietnam outfit. And had horrible heart problems. A lot of whom, I think, was because of the stuff that they got dumped on his head over there. And he ended up being in 35. He already had one bypass at 35, and now they want to do another one, and he's like 50-ish. And the state and the vets are arguing over who's going to pay for it, right?
No.
So they stick him in some nursing home out in Elgin, and I go out there. What a bleep hole. Most of the beds didn't even have sheets. The place stunk, and I'm going, I got to get him out of here. So I call this guy. Now I'm kind of buddies with the guy down in Mantino, and I said, I don't know how long he's going to last. I said, but he allegedly can have surgery, and they're going to fix him. Can I get him on the list, and can he rehab down in Mantino? And he says, well, nobody ever does, except we certainly are set up for that. He goes, we'd love to see somebody come in the front door and go out the front door.
He goes,
it never happens.
No.
So get him on the list, and sure enough, 3 weeks later, he was dead. Because nobody would, the vets and Medicaid were fighting back and forth over who was going to pay for the surgery. Can't you fight about it afterward? Why do you got to fight before, for God's sake? And he croaked when he was 55, maybe 54. Nicest guy. He was older than me. But, I mean, just a guy that there was thousands of those guys, Greg. He just never quite made it back into society. I'm sure it was like that in World War II as well.
And the government was fighting about who's going to pay for the...
Yeah, they're fighting about it. And so when you see this stuff, when everybody's, you know, this guy's not working, this guy's not working, then you see like people like Diane that have to spend... She's got to be, between the stuff she volunteers for out at Heinz and the stuff she's, the place she's building up at Great Lakes, I'm going to say she's a 70-hour a week or easy. Man, maybe 60. And what the hell? I mean, you know, the people like that, I mean, the amount of people that would volunteer down at Mantino to take these guys, they'd be volunteers. These guys are going to Sox games. They're going all over the place. Well, I won't say all over the place, but they had outings every day for people that could do it. And all these people are volunteers.
That's something to look forward to. It's nice.
Well, I mean, the fact is, a lot of people do a lot of good stuff for people. And basically get no, you know, a lot of times get no kudos for it. What is it? They say no good deed goes unpunished? No. But I mean, that whole Kankakee area should be proud of the way. I just wish they had enough money to fill the place up. I mean, because they did an unbelievable job for people. And anyway.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So, okay, how about, we got the market all over the place. We're up 84 now in the SPOOs. We're up 346 in the NASDAQ. Tariffs on, tariffs off. Wherever you are, I don't know, wherever you are on the gene pool and whether you think tariffs are good or bad, this on again, off again, based on...
What do
on
we think about the bonds?
Well, that's my next question. You're going to be... Going to be very clairvoyant, or else you actually read the stuff I send you. It could be either one of those. What'd you think of the Ray Dalio thing last night? Did you see that?
Yeah, I mean,
that's what Greg's talking about. Ray Dalio is a name. He's manages a lot of money.
Yeah, he's kind of a cult leader too, and a very astute observer of behaviors.
Yeah, he's more of not just a trader. He's more of a guy who he's like me, only he manages billions of dollars and probably smarter.
He's got ideas, and yeah. he puts the ideas into books, and if you read them, you don't know whether to be like impressed or scared. And his analysis goes way beyond just money. It's systems and governments and how they break and when they break and what to do when they're that kind of stuff, which kind of seems silly. You know, you're predicting the future, but he says he doesn't. He just kind of responds to what's going on.
Well, you know, Greg, if you have a certain amount of training, which, you know, I do, and a lot of the guys on the show, a lot of the listeners probably, you start to look at stuff and you look at where it's heading, and you try and figure out, is it sustainable or isn't it? You know, it's sort of like even in health, you know, you can have a rough weekend at the bar, but if you start doing it 3 or 4 weeks in a row, you kind of know where that's heading, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's what he does.
I've kind of liked Ray Dalio for a while, simply because, and maybe I've said this before, but he was the one who designed the hedge strategy for McDonald's for their chicken nuggets.
Okay.
So he's...
Well, he's a smart guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he thinks, like, they contracted him to say, we're going to do chicken nuggets. How do we control the price so it's the same price, you know, every day of the year? And he came up with the idea that, you know, what chicken nugget is chicken feed, and then... the cost of the time to raise and then to process the meat, stuff like that. And they ended up doing a synthetic future for that, and it saved McDonald's a lot of money. And that was, I think, I don't know, whenever they came out. But his ideas since have been dedicated mostly to macroeconomic thinking and how to allocate ungodly amounts of money. And he had a portfolio called All Weather that's, I think, outperformed bonds, but not outperformed the S&P, but by design, because it's supposed to be safe. And it's looking at his stuff now, it's kind of scary, because his analysis is saying, well, if something breaks here, this is what happens. And if the trade relationships break, this is what happens usually. If the currencies break, this is what happens usually. If there's war, this is what happens usually. And like, none of his scenarios are good scenarios, and that's always the case. But the analysis in which he goes into about the trade wars, saying this is pretty predictable, and what we're looking at is I think he did. He say recession?
No, he's actually the just to go further on what Greg's saying. Sometimes you see people that are, you know, they're trading for you or they're doing this for you, and you know people have their job, and you zero in on it. Every once in a while, you'll find somebody who either, and I think we have a few on the show actually, some people that can just disregard their the way they think about stuff and just look at the five or six things that are happening and say, wait a minute, if these all continue to happen, the end of the game is not going to be very good. And he's
and that was what was in that article.
Yeah, and he says...
They were talking about multilateralism versus unilateralism and how that kind of takes place. And he said, you know, this 90-day pause is great and reciprocal tariffs are, you know, maybe a strategy, but after that, you need to be worried about something that could be worse than a recession.
Well, he's talking about the one... By the way, you're the one who brought it up to the people on the show that there must be some sort of a shadow budget somewhere because the debt's going up bigger than they say the deficit is.
Right.
But here's
how's that happen?
Yeah, but here's his concern. He's talking about basically China and the U.S. are fighting back and forth, and it appears it's, you know, a lot of it's political. I mean, he didn't accuse, you know, Trump of getting a contribution every time, you know, he changes a thing or something like that. But he's saying these are two countries in the world that have massive debt issues, and they're fighting over tariffs.
Right.
He said, well, the problem is not in the tariff end. The problem is in the bond end. How the hell are you going to finance these deficits? You're going to run out of people to sell bonds to, especially if you're fighting with each other.
Yeah. And that's where he kind of gets into the philosophical stuff.
But that's just sort of common sense, right?
Yeah, he was talking about the value of money itself is what we have to decide now.
Sounds like me, doesn't he?
Yeah, like the back to the question of kind of where does that work, you know, what is money or where does that time and work come from if we're going to devalue our currency or we're going to, it's deeper into
Greg, why does nobody mention, and he didn't in this either, by the way, I really like this guy a lot, why don't people, you know, maybe it's because you never get an article printed or maybe you never get a favor out of government or whatever it is. The biggest examples of doing too much of what we're doing, they're right there in front of our face. I mean, I wasn't around. I don't expect people to remember the history of the Weimar Republic. But all you have to do is look at Turkey, Argentina, Venezuela. There's five or six, right now, there's five or six examples of countries that pour too much money into the system in their place. All you do is see the stock market goes up because you're pouring money into the system. But so in terms of value of their money, okay, well, the Venezuelan money, the people who own stock are doing better than anybody else, sort of like here to a certain extent. But the fact is, if you look at Turkish stock market versus U.S. dollar, it's going nowhere, right? It's probably going down compared to something else. I mean, we get away with it for a while because we have the world's biggest currency. But we're risking that, I think, because it's all in relation to something else. I mean, why can't people say, hey, do we want to be another Argentina? I mean, it's right in front of our face. Why can't somebody use the example? You know, it's like...
I think he kind of is using the example.
He is.
He's not saying, he's not saying it outright, but he's saying that if you do this kind of stuff long enough, this is what happens,
right.
and then the war starts coming, and then the you know, inflation, and then hyperinflation. And he doesn't say it directly, but if you go into the books and you know what he's talking about, he's very much saying none of this ends well unless your at least debate focuses on the issues of how to get that debt down.
Well, the bottom line is he says because of the debt load of both us and China, if we have a problem, it's going to be way more severe than the 2008 financial crisis because we won't be able to finance it, right?
Yes, but my understanding on top of that was as long as we have guidance on how we're going to fix it, that goes away for the most part. People are okay with all this debt because, you know, we've gotten here and we've been fine with it, but I think the message was You can't do this forever, and you can't surprise people too much on how you're going to fix it.
Well, let's go to break, and let's talk about that when you get back, because it's actually very key, because there has been a formula to fix it for the last 20 years, 18 years, and yet you can't believe anybody with the formula. S&P futures up 81, NASDAQ futures up 335. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jock.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm tomorrow. I'm Matt Byrne on the board. Greg Pappas in studio. S&P futures up 82. Yes, 82 is yet another reversal on tariffs. And I got an article here regarding the Chinese view on all the reversals and all the headlines and all their papers over there. Trump backs down again. What do you think of that, Greg? I don't know if I sent you that, I know. NASDAQ futures down up 327. We have the Dow up 460. Just about everybody's up. Goldman Sachs beats. They're up $9. That's almost 2%. We've got Apple up 11 because now we're pulling the tariffs back on cell phones. Pretty unbelievable. Really kind of unbelievable. I keep saying that, but whatever. DAX up 498, 2.5%. FTSE up 139, 1.7%. CAC around up 154, 2%. We're in Asia. Now, these guys have been all over the place. Nikkei is only was up way more, but it was 396. It's 1.1%. Hang Seng's up 500. It's over 2%. Shanghai is up 24.7%. The only one that's not moving that much is mainland China. Friday, We ran up in the afternoon. The Dow was up 619, S&P up 95, and NASDAQ up 337 is obviously, well, obviously to me, the trader, this announcement Saturday morning, some people had it Friday, and it's really starting to get aggravating, but nothing I can do about it. Bonds down 6 basis points, 4.43. These are 10-year. The Bund unchanged, 2.54. Japan unchanged, 1.34. Oil, which has been getting clobbered. It's back up 62.38. Greg, I hope you were right when you're in your crack spread over there, because, boy, this thing got under 60, didn't it, last week? Brent up 85 cents, 65.61. Natural gas down 4 cents, 3.48. RBOB up 4 cents, 2.03. I tell you what, RBOB has not come down at all with the oil going from 72 to 62, and it's kind of surprising. Gas by me is not going down at all. Gold down $6, 32.38. It's been on a tear. Silver up another 39 cents, 32.30. Copper up 7 cents, 4.59. Foreign exchange, and this has been a hotbed here. The euro is up again, 113. It was 108.5 3 weeks ago. So what is that, Greg? 4% in a currency is a massive move. And if you've never traded them, you don't realize that, but that's like a year and a half, 2 year move, isn't it, Greg?
That's the profit margin for some of those manufacturers, yep, and importer exporters.
And all of a sudden, it's either gone or double, well, depending on which way you're going.
Whoops.
British pound up 1 basis point, 1.3, almost 1.32. That was in the 128.9 range a few weeks ago. Bitcoin up 804, 84,802. Rhea Force, Traffic, Weather, Sports.
Good morning. It's currently 6:42 a.m. on April 14th, 2025. Let's look at weather in Chicago. It's 59 degrees at Midway and 58 at O'Hare. High of around 62 today, partly sunny and breezy. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 40 degrees with a slight chance of showers. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, 71 degrees right now. Warm with clouds giving way to sun and a high of 94 degrees today. In sports, we have the MLB. Cubs played against the Dodgers yesterday and won 4-2. This marks the Cubs' 11th win this season compared to their 7 losses. White Sox played against the Red Sox and lost 3-1.
Are they going to have their 11th win by the 4th of July?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see about that. But we do have the Masters Tournament in golf that took place, wrapped up yesterday, with Rory McIlroy of Northern Ireland coming out on top and winning $4,200,000. In second place, Justin Rose of England and Patrick Reed of the USA in third place. So I got, Chief, back to you.
In the words of my Irish buddy, I don't know if he's still alive, Larry Murphy, he's not Irish, he's from the North. What do you think of that?
I have to talk to...
I'm sure he thinks he's Irish, but he's not Irish, he's from the North. What do you think of that, John? How are you?
I'm good, Tom. How about you?
All right, boy, your name was bandied about yesterday, huge.
Oh.
Let's say the ladies had
in what context, man?
The ladies had a big a luncheon at the... What's the name of the place? I don't know. I'll think of it. Was really good. It was Nancy, Audrey, Kathy, and Mary Kelly. Diane Kelly, the lady who's been on the show a couple times.
Okay.
In the first half hour, if we were listening, we were talking about the veterans' homes and stuff, and I guess I had forgotten, or not forgotten, but I should have known. She goes, the amazing amount of the people staying in the Fisher House up here are people that come up here for their chemotherapy from Vietnam that got doused with Agent Orange. I kind of thought most of those people were dead already, but I guess if they're not, a lot of them have cancer.
Yeah, no telling that the total cost for that entire era, really. I mean, it's still going on.
Still going on. It's it costs physical and mental. So these families are driving up from Southern Illinois, and a couple people stay in the Fisher House, and the person goes through their whatever 3-4 days a week of chemo treatment, and they go back down, and 2 weeks later they come back up, and it's most of the people staying in the Fisher House are either those people or people doing stuff on artificial limbs. And evidently the one here does a lot on vision as well. If you got burns, you're in Texas. Anyway, the ladies were asking about you.
I am flattered.
They said, where's John? I said, I don't know. I have something to do with his sock drawer. I don't know. But no, it was a nice conversation. Bonefish, the name of the place. And they do a nice job.
Oh, yeah. I know Bonefish.
And, well, it's one of Kathy's accounts. She works with Southern Beverage. And, They hustle. People are nice. They like working there. It's It's a chain, but it...
It's a chain, yeah. I've been in the one out in the western suburbs.
I think the person who runs it gets to do a lot of stuff on his own. And they have these dinners that the girls, too, will go to on Thursday where everything's all-inclusive, like four courses, and they try and show all their stuff. And every course includes, you know, some bizarre alcoholic drink. And yesterday was, you know, it was a brunch. You had, like, four different courses of lunch, and I thought it was really good. I enjoyed myself. It was like I thought to Diane was always incredible. I mean, you learn more about what's going on, you know, in the government. The amount of people that volunteer, Jan, it's pretty scary. She's cooking dinner for 30 by herself Sunday for Easter.
Wow.
And they must have a kitchen there, I guess. And she's cooking away. And Diane's a great cook, and whatever. So, anyway, you would have added. We had one more spot. Plus, we could have flipped you to Bill, too, you know. Hey, where's Jan? And Bill came.
He's always up front, happy to help.
Jan's in the bathroom. How long is he going to be? Well, until somebody else pays, he's peeking out through the door. So what do you make of all this stuff? We're up today. We've got tariffs that people thought were a great idea. Now they're on again, off again, to the point where I don't know if you can plan on them or what you're doing. The Chinese are, their headlines are all Trump backs down again. Then we have Ray Dalio, if you listen to that part, saying that we have the two countries in the world that got the biggest debt issues fighting over tariffs and how stupid that is. So,
well, the Chinese are you know, expected to play this just as they're doing it, and you know, their media, I would say, is no more credible than our mainstream media. So they're not going to spin this in a way that's, you know, damaging to the party, or to, you know, to anything Chinese. So I put that aside because I don't trust anything they say publicly, because it's meant to allay fears that I think are very real in China. And this is one thing that's I think this tariff snafu is going to, you know, ratchet up, that they don't have, you know, a handle on things at all. And this maybe was the strategy at some level to expose this, certainly to expose how countries like Apple can't produce iPhones at an affordable price without offshoring, you know, all the important stuff. So I think that point needs to be, you know, driven home, that this situation has developed over a long period, and it's been cultivated and encouraged at every level. And, you know, this is a kind of wake-up call. This, you know, was a bad idea from the get-go, at least to let it go this far. And now, you know, when it has to be dialed back, the only way you can have any kind of tariff policy is by cutting these things out, because the consumers in this country are not going to go for, you know, $3,000-$4,000 iPhone.
Well, I was surprised, and it always seems to be stunning to me that when you go and look, something happens. There's tariffs are doing this back and forth, and we talk on the show, and obviously you hear a lot about it. People are, Apple's over in China. What are we doing? You know, and how it's all working. Everybody has their point of view. And everybody knows everything about everything, right? Until, of course, you actually look at some of the facts, and nobody, including myself, usually has a clue until you actually look at them. I did some work last week. I am stunned that Apple has only 14,000 people that are under their employ in China. Yet their distribution system, as Kevin would probably call it, or supply chain system, has 1.5 million people servicing Apple. Largest one being Foxconn, which I think, Greg, they make the screens. What else do they make? I think they make at least the screens. And you know, this article I was reading, a guy says for not just the 14,000 people that Apple maybe could move someplace. What about the rest of it? We don't have 1.5 million people in this country sending. You know, sent. So then you hit them with the sledgehammer over the head. Okay. You better get back here because the tariffs are now, you know, 100%, 140 for China. Okay, let's say if your goal is to have Jan Flanagan open up a cell phone manufacturer here, and Jan runs his behind around every bank he knows last week and gets $5 billion worth of financing, he's ready to break ground Saturday morning, and all of a sudden they change their mind. Well, what are we doing, Jan? I mean, we're not... The people that are doing this, I mean, I'm not saying the Democrats would be any better because they don't know anything about it either, have no idea of the, it appears, the length of time and the what would have to happen for somebody to bring 20% of that over here. It could be a 10-year plan. Certainly five. I'm hoping not 10, but I'm going to say 5 to 7. I mean, the machinations we're going through now are not helping that at all, are they? Or to my mind, they're not.
Well, you know, what we have now is, I would say it's a 40 to 50 year process. What, you know, the offshoring. I mean, it really got ramped up after NAFTA. That's,
when was ping pong diplomacy? Was that, were we in college?
That was the 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like the mid 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, NAFTA, you know, was 94, so that's, you know, over 30 years now. So any kind of disruption of the kind of direction we've been going in is got to be looked at in equivalent terms. It's not going to happen in 6 weeks. It's not going to happen in 6 years, where you get, you know, companies to, you know, agree to come back to this country and build plants and hire people and everything else. And yet, it, by not encouraging that, or, you know, incentivizing it, you can push the can down the road, you know, for another couple decades and not even, you know, see that as a valuable policy. So it has to start somewhere, and it's not going to be a fast process, nor you know, could it be in any kind of, you know, perfect world. But it doesn't, you know, get us anywhere to limp along with what we've been encouraging up to now. And I think any kind of reversal of that is going to send shockwaves and is going to cause long delays and frustrations down the road. But it has to go in that direction to equalize somewhat, and, you know, we have to be patient.
Well, what are we trying to equalize? And I mean, and I don't say this, I say this, John, because I actually did, well, undergrad, if you could call it, taking a class of Coach Leahy. But international economics and in labor economics, if you put the two of them together, it's a very complicated subject. And my concern on this whole mess, and I really don't care if it's Democrats or Republicans doing it. I mean, being in the middle, you look at both sides and you shake your head. I don't think the people doing it know what the hell they're doing. I mean, when I say that, if you go to, let's say, Jan Flanagan works for a metalworking company, and you're in an area where you're in Chicago and you're working at night, and guess what? The electricity is almost free at night because the nuclear plants are still on and everybody's asleep. All of a sudden, because of the electricity, the power being cheap, and because maybe the machinery in this country is better, John Flanagan is going to make your marginal benefit to that place is going to be astronomical if you know what you're doing. So you could be worth 25, 35, 50, $100 an hour because you have all these other factors of production. You can get financing in the U.S. There's all kinds of stuff that can happen to put John Flanagan in the best place there is in terms of being, of when you walk in the door, the minute you start working, you're making, for your $50 an hour, you're making this guy $250 worth of profit or worth of stuff. And there's all these comparative advantages on everything. If you go somewhere, if you have a sawmill, you're probably better off putting it in Canada than you are in Cook County. Where the hell are you going to get the trees here? How much can you pay the guy? Well, nothing, because you know, there's all these advantages that are the reasons why people trade. I mean, when you go to, quote, Vietnam, they don't have the infrastructure that we do. They have more people. Their comparative advantage is, economically, and that's, is the people are willing to work for less. I'm not talking about all the rice you can eat, but for a less number, because there's more of them, and over time, maybe some of the other stuff will even out, but they probably still won't have the power we do. They still probably won't. So if the people here make $30 an hour and the people in Vietnam make 15 or 20 or 10 or 12, it's probably part of the growing process, part of, there's no need for tariffs there, okay, because our guy is still more valuable, given the other stuff, than their guy is. But now when you reach China and you go, wait a minute, they're using slave labor, they're pouring pollution into the air, which eventually we're going to have to breathe. Someplace along the line here, it doesn't become clean. And Carl's always talking about you need to average that out somehow, or you need to. But the whole puzzle is an amazingly complex piece of work. You know, just because somebody pays people a little less somewhere doesn't mean they have an advantage over people here. It doesn't mean you have to drag them back. Do we really want to drag back people making $5 an hour to make t-shirts and somehow find a way to pay them $20 an hour here? I don't think we have any comparative advantage on t-shirts, do we? I mean, I don't think we do. I guess we have a little power advantage. We maybe have a little land issue. But we really don't have... I'm saying this is so complex that if you just run around and tariffs today and no tariffs... I don't know what you're accomplishing. This is not a political... I mean, if the Democrats are doing it, I'd say the same thing. I mean, what are you doing? Where am I wrong here?
We've had a legacy here of completely misguided policy with China.
Without a doubt.
Somehow we got the idea that if we gave them, enough investment and technology and let them produce things up the wazoo for their people and raise their living standards, democratize them, eventually they'd overthrow their oppressive government and, adopt our model. I mean, this is the most insane misapplication of energy imaginable. It's been institutionalized really since the Nixon era. This was kind of, the idea of opening it up was, to somehow give it, the blessings of, Western thought and, Western governance, and everybody would eventually get on board with it, and, we'd have accomplished our geopolitical goals through economic strategies. But to me, this is like it's gone exactly in the opposite direction from what it was designed to do.
Well, Jenna, where's the fault? I mean, if I'm going to say I saw this happen once. Talk about the world's craziest recommendation, right? I told you, I went to this Economic Club of Chicago dinner, and I was one of the first people there. And there's a cocktail hour, which only like a couple little tables, so there's no place really to have your cocktail. So if you want to get there first, so you can have a place to put your drink. So I'm sitting down, this lady comes over, and she's talking to me. It turns out she works at the Chinese embassy. And I go, that's interesting. If somebody wanted to put something, this is when all this was kind of starting to happen, 15 years ago or whatever. Well, people started to talk about it here, right? Well, you're right. It was more like a 30-year program. I said, if somebody wants to put something over there, maybe we just had the guy on from the coatings, the coatings for the pots and pans. Anyway, so I start talking to her, and she goes, oh yeah, if you want to put something over there, you come and see us, and we'll hook you up with somebody, which my ears, of course, pock right up like a dog. We'll hook you up with somebody, and we'll figure out what province you want to be in, and we'll help you with this, help you with that. And you'll have your, quote, I use the term consultant, which means a party guy, right? Or a party girl. And not in a term you'd like to have, party guy or party girl. We'll essentially set you up. So I'm thinking, okay, now there's somebody in the middle here getting a bunch of scratch to maybe keep their thumb on the neck of labor in your factory to make sure you don't have a problem at 5 cents an hour, whatever they're making. Now, how does that, and if the person happens to be part of the political system, how does Apple and a million other people over there, if they're essentially paying all this money off to the people in the Communist Party, because there's an awful lot of rich people in the Communist Party, aren't there more millionaires in China who've grown in the last decade than any other place in the world? I mean, if they're getting paid off for all this stuff, how is that not a problem with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act? I mean, if you're paying the party $20 million a year to make sure you don't have a strike at your plant because you're paying guys 50 cents an hour, how is that moral? When we're part of, you just said the Chinese government is not letting it happen. We're right with it, aren't we? Or we're the companies
it. We're enabling it.
Yeah.
There's things that are just, the normal business in China, I think, where, if you want to go in and, build a plant and have a cooperative, agreement with province so-and-so or party member so-and-so or whatever, you're going to give up all of your controlling interest in whatever you're trying to build or produce there, because they're going to demand a controlling interest to enable you to build anything.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. You're right. They want a controlling interest on top of it.
Well, could you imagine that? What if that were in place in this country?
what you just mentioned earlier, we thought that people economically, they would grow. They're not being able to grow because people got their finger on their neck, and we're the ones paying the guys to keep the finger on the neck. Right.
And it's, we are not shining models of intelligent capitalism, maybe, but what you've got in China now is rapacious, no holds barred, crooked capitalism, which, you know, is state institutionalized. It isn't just, it's like casino capitalism. The government has got its fingers on every scale. And if you want to do business with them, you'll they'll be happy to let you do it, but on their terms.
Well, Jack, could those guys be enriching themselves if the companies over there weren't paying them directly?
I don't see how, not in the amount, you know, we see. It's got to be some kind of, you know, so much of this is graft, and, you know, it's favors, and, you know, it's happening on this side of the ocean too, with, you know, people in Congress who have been paid to be shills for Chinese interests. They're no better.
Well, I think I probably told you this maybe over a beer, but I have a good friend, and she's in sort of an ad business. She tries to put stuff together for big people, and hopefully one day she'll be very successful at it. But at one point, she has a mathematical system that I don't understand all that much. It has to do with, it's not the mathematics where you're multiplying and dividing. It's the mathematics where you keep track of everything. It's almost like a salesman holding coloring problem. It's that type of mathematics where you just maneuver things and you keep it in sets. And anyway, if I knew more about it, I could explain it better. But the people of the United Nations called her, and they wanted her to put this kind of thing together, because the army, evidently, or the armed forces, has a scanner of some kind where you can take a scan of a container, and this thing will tell you, not only you got a spherical object in there, it'll tell you it's a basketball. I mean, it's really something from what I gather. I've never seen it. And the idea was the UN wanted to stop a lot of smuggling and stuff. They want these things to be essentially at the port, say someplace in Africa. And when the container got to New Orleans, they wanted to scan the container again, and if they didn't match up, they wanted to reject it. Which, you know, if you want to stop smuggling, something like that kind of makes some sense. Well, they ended up, her system, they gave her a UN passport to figure out how this was going to happen. And of course, it got more complicated because the UN wanted to do it. And they essentially wanted a toehold in every one of these countries, Jen, because it was coming in through the sports part. I'm not speaking out of school here. This is a long time ago. They wanted a country to essentially give them, let's say, 2 square miles of port land, and they were going to put up a few some sports fields. They were going to put up a hospital, essentially a staging ground for a lot of the stuff they wanted to do in terms of taking care of people. But they wanted the hospital and all this stuff to be on essentially property ceded to the UN, and they were going to also, and they're going to have this port facility on this property. And if we're going to give this kind of money, we want it to be ours, which I guess I don't have a problem with. You know, I never saw the details of it, but to do this, say to scan the container, let's say it's $1,000. Well, the Banana Republic dictator, he wanted $10 or $20. Or I'm not letting you in. So the UN says, okay, the guy's got a Swiss bank account, and every time, now she ended up, she quit. She goes, I the corruption was so bizarre, I don't want any part of these people. She quit. So she never did any of this. But I did see her passport, though. It was light purple. It was cool looking. But she said, yeah, all these guys, now, you and I are building the water treatment plant. In order to get it done, we got to pay off the police and the guy there, so our stuff doesn't disappear. Are we enablers? What are we? On one hand, we just say, we don't care. It's the price of doing business. We want to get clean water for these kids because it looks to me like they don't look so hot. Or do you assassinate them, which you probably shouldn't? What do you do? I mean, these are not easy questions. My guess is some company like maybe a Vietnam that is somewhat straight, whatever that means, and they just happen to have more labor than we do, and their labor rates are less because they have more human capital than we do. I guess economically, I don't have a real problem with that. Now, if somebody goes over there and pays some Vietnamese guy a lot of money to make sure the people in the plant never say, "Hey, I'm not getting paid enough," well, maybe I got a problem with that. Where are you on this on the moral scale? I mean, it's hard to find your spot, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and you don't have to look very far before you see some layer of corruption or quid pro quo. That's just a given. It's non-negotiable. If you want to do X, you're going to have to also go along with Y. And this is, you know, why the you know, China's Belt and Road Initiative was an attempt to sort of, you know, back this up in favor of the Chinese, so that they got more than just, you know, it wasn't just like paying off officials. It was, you know, assuming control of the local economy or the local businesses all over the place in the process too. And it's worked in some places and it hasn't worked at all in others, but they went in with a much more aggressive philosophy than just, you know, Peace Corps type initiatives, or, you know, going in and having to deal with the local oligarchs or the ruling family and pay off the people you had to, and then, you know, take your chances what was going to happen next. The U.S. has a pretty bad record, if you think about it, in the way it has created monsters like this, whether it's in Central America with United Fruit Company or you name it. But, you know, we had to get in bed with the people we, you know, were better advised not to get in bed with. But we had, you know, we saw the dollar signs and had to, like, cave in on all these other, you know, areas where we might have been able to hold our guns to our guns if we had not been so dazzled by the profits. And this is, you know, what it does is breed bad feelings for generations in these countries.
Well, if done right, if it's done properly, it doesn't. I mean,
right, but the way it's been conducted, it shouldn't in theory either, but it's now become, you know, it's got a bad stench attached to it. And I think, you know, the American hell-bent investment in China reeks of the same stench. It's just,
well, we paid off Chinese people to screw their own people.
Right, right.
Which I think,
and
we did.
Our people too.
I have a feeling we've done that in Mexico as well. You know? I mean, these gangs wouldn't have all this money if we didn't give some of it. And why do you think these people in these factories are so? But, you know, it's when you talk about that, America, the U.S. has done a lot of this. Pullman did a lot of this, but Janik, it also can really work. I mean, one of the things that was interesting about Pullman is they had Kellogg. Pullman Kellogg was one of the divisions. They also had Pullman Swindell and the guys that were who's the asbestos guys. They used to be Pullman. Was that Pullman? Kellogg? Who was the guys that are with Cheney's old firm? Kellogg Brown. Kellogg Brown and Root. Kellogg was with Pullman when I was there, and they built, you know, like what do you call big the things that crack the oil, big refineries and stuff. So Pullman, actually Robin, worked on a lot of this stuff. That's what the Export and Import Bank is about. It's the idea that you would, if Saudi Arabia or someplace wanted a refinery, Kellogg would design the refinery. Swindell made stacks, which means chimney, but don't ever call it a chimney if you're with one of those guys. It's a stack. And a lot of times these places, so like Robin was one of the team that would go to the Export and Import Bank, and the company over there probably didn't have the money to get the financing, so Pullman would work the financing through the Export Import Bank. And so the entire cost of the refinery was run through Pullman, even though Kellogg's income was the $10 million that they paid for the engineering stuff. Now, maybe the whole cost of the facility was $100 million, and Pullman's revenue was only $10. It looked like it was $100 because it all came through Pullman. But in fact, the Import-Export Bank sort of guaranteed the loan, okay, that Pullman took out to build this place. But the thing of it was, John, it was a refinery. The refinery made money. It was a water treatment facility that charged for the treatment. It wasn't, I mean, that's why I think the Chinese are screwed up. If we just went there and said, we'll build you a road, what does that get you? I mean, I don't think Pullman ever lost on one, and nor did the Import-Export Bank, because the refinery made enough money to pay the loan back. And what the U.S. got from this was the fact that we sent workers over there, they behaved themselves, they built the place, they used local workers, and it was all done. Those guys had a refinery and paid all the loans back, paid Pullman, and they had a refinery going forward. I don't have a problem with that. That's why I think the Chinese, I think, are kind of screwing themselves up by just going and saying, well, we'll build you a road, we'll build you this. Well, you're not. It's not a toll road. How do you get any money back from that?
You'll get it back in other ways.
Well, maybe.
Political leverage and, you know, promises down the road.
I'd rather get my check from the place I just built instead of thinking I'm an influence politics. I mean, you're right. It could work out that way. But Pullman got the same, points from the population by building something that made sense rather than a political takeover because of a road. I mean, which would you rather have? I mean, Pullman ended up getting, or the U.S., ended up getting, I'll use good feel, you know, good points, boy, from the place just by helping them out with the refinery. You didn't need to build a road and pay people off and try and get it. That's very inefficient, I think.
It is. Very inefficient. Well, you know, the Pullman model, Tom, is, I mean, that was a great advance. We're talking the 19th century model.
Well, we're talking about, this was all going on in the late 70s. I'm talking about the Import-Export Bank. That's what it was for originally. Then it became lending people money to buy Boeing warplanes. Well, that's different.
Yeah, but the idea the Pullman, you know, championed and made work for a while, where you owned the town, you owned everybody's house, you paid them in company scrip. They had to buy their groceries and services at your approved company store. This was the kind of total control that, you know, has sort of been accepted in China when it comes to, you know, at least until the last 20 or 30 years, when people started to feel their oats and rebelling against it. But it was, you know, you were beholden to the government. You were beholden to an employer in a way that, you know, Americans stopped putting up with 150 years ago.
John, there's still a reason why George Pullman is buried under a bunch of layers of concrete.
Yeah.
Imagine that, having to be buried under a bunch of layers of concrete because people think they're going to come desecrate the grave.
He was not.
Yeah, he a popular guy? No, I don't think he was. Then he got the Pinkertons to shoot people when they struck. He was not the best.
But, you know, by comparison, take Western Electric, which we talk about frequently on the show, as another economic model where it was an enormous operation with, you know, good wages. Even, you know, some of the motor companies too, Ford and so on, elevated workers. This was seen as their, you know, you don't sell a car that your own work employees can't afford, you know, to buy. So this was kind of revolutionary. But it's
well, 20 bucks an hour in the mid 70s essentially made the middle class.
Yeah,
40 grand a year when a car was three, a house was, I'm going to say, 45. Notre Dame education was four. It was a different world in terms of your buying power, correct?
Oh, God. Unrecognizable.
Oh, my God. Somebody wants to invite us to a White Sox game. I think we probably won't go, eh? Just saying. Where do you think this all plays out, though, Jack? I mean, even if you like, I actually like some of the stuff these guys are doing. I'm somewhat of a believer with Carl and having the even up sort of tariffs. And you know what's funny? I sent you all the right wingers, just to piss you guys off. I found that thing on YouTube about Ronald Reagan talking about what horrible ideas tariffs are. And in one sense, I agreed with everything he said, but I also realized it came from a time when a lot of stuff that we're seeing now wasn't happening. Right. So, I mean, everything, I don't know, I use the example all the time where we're not going to let Flanagan Inc. pour crummy water in the Rio Grande, but we're going to let, you know, Matt Byrne Inc. run across the river and pour it in from the other side. I mean, I don't think Reagan necessarily ever thought of that. So how do you even that up? Now, Carl thinks tariffs is the way. I don't know that it's necessarily the way. I'd rather probably tell Mexico, unless you start, I would do it differently. I would say, unless you don't pour water in a river that we're both drinking out of, you idiot, we're not going to buy anything from you. I'd be a little more forceful than just tariffs, because I don't know if you can even that up. You're never going to charge enough to actually clean up the river, are you? So I mean,
no, nor can it really be ever considered a permanent revenue stream of any kind.
So I mean, I don't know if that would be the way I would do it. I don't exactly know what you do about the slave labor. I'll tell you, if we can prove that the companies are paying people off over there to keep people enslaved, I think I have a problem with the company. Don't you?
Oh, hell yeah.
Well, I don't see any of that, do you? I mean, I don't think anybody's even whispering that. So, I mean, I think, you know, again, my solution to everything is always get people from both sides of the aisle, if you can find somebody competent, four or five people, go to Camp David for the weekend and put everything on the table and say, what are we going to do? These are the problems we're seeing. I think you might actually find a few smart people if you keep them away from their trading thing for whatever. I mean, there needs to be solutions. I actually think we might have people in Washington that are smart enough to do it. I don't. This chaos we don't need. There might be. This is very complicated stuff.
John. I just want to stick up for chaos for a minute.
Okay. All right. Go ahead with that.
But you know, I was talking to my brother the other day about tariffs, and he was telling me, well, one of the reasons that so many people object to tariffs is because they work. They really do. You know, put a squeeze on people that they'd rather not have to deal with.
They put the squeeze on who? We pay it.
Well, we the companies that are producing goods that have tariffs on them have to find a market that they can't depend
on. Maybe not. It depends on every.
Yeah, that's the thinking of it behind a tariff. And at least in my book, it's about consumption patterns. And if you start to discourage people from buying product A from company so-and-so, that's successful. But in this kind of climate where we haven't had any kind of apparently way of dealing with a China-like operation other than just to feed the beast and keep it going and make it even more powerful, I think you have to have recklessness built into the whole process to undo that and to not make it look like this is a very cold strategy. You know, it could be a 145%, it could be 146%. You had Kevin O'Leary saying we should put 400% tariffs on China.
Kevin O'Leary, I don't know what his motivation is, but when I listen to him, I have no idea where he's coming from.
This is part of his recklessness that I'm kind of sticking up for. Unless you show your willingness to go whole hog and to change on a dime and go some other direction, you really don't have any reason to get involved with the stated goal
is the tariffs are going to even up the playing field so people will feel confident investing here. If that's the goal, they're not accomplishing that at all. Maybe it's not the goal.
I don't think that's not the immediate goal anyway, I don't think. I mean, it's about...
Well, I hope it's not to get somebody to come here and kiss my ass and give me $1 million, which you could look at this guy and say, maybe I'm going to give him a break and say, I don't think that's the goal, but you could appear to that. I mean, Elizabeth Warren this weekend, he throws a tariff on somebody, they come and give him a bunch of money, he takes the tariff off. She goes, what kind of government is that? Now, I'm not a Elizabeth Warren fan, but it kind of looks like that to some people. I hope it isn't.
Well, they're going to have to, you know, the idea of caving with the Apple products and that, I expected something like that because the consumers here would not put up with it otherwise. And I think the Chinese fully expected there to be carve-outs as well. It's about getting people to renegotiate. And the one thing the globalists hate, I think, is for two countries who have a common interest that they can talk about and negotiate and exchange intelligence or technology or businesses or whatever, and screw the rest of, you know, the people who are in line to, you know, bargain for those same things, to do it on a bilateral basis. The globalists have no patience with that and haven't for a long time. It's got to be our way or you know, the highway.
Well,
one thing's tariffs, I think, have a primary motivation for is to get people to work out deals one-on-one with each other. And this is why I think that idea was to freeze out China from the get-go.
You know, China's exports are up 12% last month.
Yeah, because they're front-loading to escape the tariffs.
Well, maybe. You know, I'm saying every one of these things, that a lot of, you know, my barking back at people on the show and everybody who talks about this, I think... I don't know, John, maybe because I did some of this. Every one of these products, every country is so unique, so complicated, and everybody tosses these numbers around like if they know what they're talking about. And every, say something comes from China, there's three variables here. Okay, somebody decides, Trump, you, Pelosi, whoever it is, we're going to wing a tariff and pick one item. We're gonna run a big tariff on cola nuts, which you make whatever Coca Cola out of. I don't know where the hell those even come from. Say Kenya or someplace. All right, so we're gonna at the border. Somebody, when $1,000 worth of cola nuts come in, the importer's got to pay the guy $1,000 or however he pays him. He's got to turn around and write a check for the tariffs are 20%. He's got to write a $200 check to the U.S. government. That we know for sure. I mean, I'm going to say that 80% of the people who are talking about this have no idea that that's paid here and they don't, and not the other country. Now, to what you're talking about, the other country is going to go, holy bleep, Batman. Now what? What if they're getting cola nuts from five other places and growing some of their own, and it's a semi-competitive market? We're going to sit there and say, well, nobody's going to buy our stuff up 20%. We're going to sort of adjust that and drop our price by 10%. That's like variable two. If it's the only place in the world that cola nuts exist, I'm going to say they're not hurt at all. Or if they are, it's 1% or something, because maybe somebody will shift from Coca-Cola to iced tea or something. That could possibly happen. But now then, that adds another level of complexity that of the competitors to the final product, even though there may not be another competitor for the cola nut itself, correct? So, I mean, this starts to expand like there's no tomorrow. So then you say, okay, those guys say, well, you know, maybe there is a competitor somewhere. We're gonna shave 10% off our price. So now the tariff is now 20%, but now it's really only on a less price. So instead of being 20%, it really comes down to 20% of 90%, which is 18%, right? And that, so the government's now not getting a check for 200. They're getting a check for 180. So the whole mess is eaten, essentially blunted by $180. I'm sorry. Now on this end, Coca-Cola is the only place that uses cola nuts. They're going to say, okay, we now compete with iced tea and orange knee-high and whatever the hell else it is. We don't want to be raising the price of our Coke 20%. We're going to eat, some percentage. But now they eat a little bit. So actually, your price, when you and I walk down the Coca-Cola aisle, maybe it's down to 8%, not 20%. Even though the U.S. government's getting this check for 20%. Now, you and I might also own the grape knee-high. And we go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Looky here. Coke is up 12%. Maybe we can sneak the price in grape knee-high up 5%, and we're still 7 cents cheaper competitively with Coke. Why don't we try that for a while? And see, so you may end up doing nothing. The only thing you know you did for sure was take the money to the government. That's the only thing you know for sure, John. It's this, and multiply that by how many products and how many countries we're talking about.
Yeah, well, the whole China thing, we let get completely out of hand. We thought we could extort political change out of them by our insane trade policies, and we failed miserably. The government's more entrenched than ever, probably. The people are probably much less free than they ever were 20 years ago, maybe, for all I know. But that was a complete wash. I mean, and it backfired, spectacularly. So what options do we have now?
Okay,
other than tariffs, I don't...
Well, back up a hair on that. The people that are considered the villains in all this are my dear departed teacher I liked a lot, Milton Friedman. Those are the economist screwed this up. And I actually was in a class, I remember, where he was talking about tariffs. And he was a proponent of this, economic development essentially breeds political change and blah, blah, blah. And I've been one of the harshest critics on that. But I have a feeling, Jan, if you could drag him out of the grave and stick him up in a blackboard and he were to talk about his feelings, sort of like Ronald Reagan's on tariffs, by the way, if you were to say, Professor Friedman, what if, and I know you're going to say this couldn't possibly happen, what if it turned into some sort of a mess where the companies went over to China, started to pay off the Chinese politicians to make sure that labor could never do what you wanted them to do? I have a feeling he would say, Hmm. Well, if they were able to do that, what I just said probably doesn't work out so well. Right? It's another variable.
Right.
I mean, when Ronald Reagan was talking about it, he was talking about pure tariff. We just don't want to do that because all it does is screw up world trade. But if you were to say, what if 25 countries essentially paid the gangs in Mexico more money to make sure nobody ever goes on strike, I think that's a variable you'd want to consider, wouldn't it?
Of course.
Well, why did we let it happen? And now we're blaming Milton Friedman and the Chinese people.
Well,
instead of the firms and the people, the Chinese government that took all the dough, they're doing fine.
And the companies that, you know, closed their plants in the U.S. and, you know, offshored everything, not just to China but everywhere else, is sitting pretty too.
Jen, talk about how that happened. I have a very serious question to ask you about. We only got a couple minutes. Well, actually, we'll talk about when Audrey's on.
I have to bow out at 7:30 today, Tom.
Okay, we had a discussion. How did companies like Rheem and how, because they're still around, or they have a name, how did Rheem and some of these steel companies manage to bow out and go somewhere else and ditch out on their pension stuff? Weren't the ERISA laws strong enough? How did that money ever, did they ever take that dough and not have it? I mean, because a lot of these companies left just to screw the employees here. They got away with not paying the pensions, which was a huge incentive to leave that we're not even talking about. So how did they do that? I have no idea.
Yeah, it needs some research. I couldn't say off the top of my head. They succeeded. I know that.
I think what Rheem did is they offered people a chance to transfer to Mexico or someplace, and when the answer was no, they just fired them and said they don't get your pension or something along those lines. How do you pull that off?
Well, that's supposedly why we had ERISA.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, ERISA is the reason why Pullman got taken over, because if you go back to the 70s when interest rates were 12 and 15% and most pension funds, because Robin was on the board of Pullman Pension Fund. Again, it's like three variables. When you get down to how many people are working there, you go get a actuary to say, how long are these people going to live? If they all work till they're 65, how much are we going to have to pay? And then somebody, because what is your pension going to pay out? How much is it going to grow per year? And then somebody is going to say, how much over the next 30 years are we going to make? And hopefully nobody's going to say like 20% like the market did the last 2 years. The number was like, what, John? 4, 5, something like that.
Yeah.
5.5, maybe. And so once you do that and you take the actuarial stuff, you bounce back in, these amount of people you're covering, you say to Pullman, you owe $20 million this year. And at the end of the 70s, when people were actually making, you know, 14% in the bank and on a T-bill, everybody was way oversubscribed in terms of cash. But if it's your company, you can't pull the money out because of the ERISA laws. But if somebody takes it over, they can buy each one of those people an annuity based on what their return is going to be when they're 65, which is at the now 5% range when the thing... And they're going to pull that money out. Because I think Wheelabrator was able to pull $40, $50, $60, $70 million out of the Pullman Pension Fund back when that was like a real lot of money. And I think that's the reason why United Airlines became UAL Inc. A lot of these steel companies all changed names. When they were oversubscribed, they took the money out. And over the next several years, when they couldn't afford to put it in, people were just bleep out of luck. And I don't think... talk about a way to get around the ERISA laws, huh, Jen?
Well,
I'll say. I mean, I think a lot of our... I mean, Carl is, I think, absolutely correct that the non-enforcement of laws over a long period of time have really screwed people in this country to a huge extent. And even today, it's going on in medical and other places. And, you know, obviously, we're not going to take people in the streets and shoot them and stuff. But you get to the point where you're like, when is this going to change? And the answer appears to be, like, never. And now we're blaming Milton Friedman for guys paying off Chinese politicians, right? Well, that's interesting.
Rather than revoke laws, we'd rather just, you know, pay people not to enforce them.
Well, yeah. Or choose which ones you're going to enforce them.
Yeah.
So it's the question I want to ask you is, the guys were talking, a couple of the attorneys for tonight were talking about titles. And I'm going to talk to Audrey about this when she comes in. We're talking about why people don't use, or trusts, why people don't use trusts anymore. And the two attorneys were saying, yeah, it's still a really good idea in Illinois and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, it can't be. Something must have changed because I haven't heard Nancy or Audrey talking about a trust transaction in 20 years. And it turns out from Nancy, I talked to her at our brunch, she goes, yeah, there's no trust companies left that'll do it. And if you get a mortgage, you got to pull it out of the trust, get the mortgage, and put it back in. She goes, they've made it so cumbersome to deal with that even though the law hasn't changed, nobody does it anymore. Is that true?
Yeah, that, you know, that's that restriction on, you know, at least residential property, that they didn't want, the lender didn't want, you know, borrower taking title in a land trust. You can put in a land trust later on. But of course, the beauty of the land trust is you can't track ownership once it's in a land trust, because if there's an assignment behind the scenes of a beneficial interest, it doesn't have to be recorded. Nobody knows, you know, you could have a completely separate, you know, hands, you know, arm's length transaction with the same trust owning the property. And back when lenders were enforcing acceleration clauses, you know, due on sale clauses, and, you know, people were skating, you know, and selling property without having to tell the lender about it, so you could stick with the interest rate even though it was a completely new person occupying the property. Lenders didn't go for that, so they tried to ditch land trusts. You can still find places that will do them, and there was a set of two title companies and banks. I mean, some of the smaller banks actually still have land trust departments, and it's a great device.
Well, let's talk about it next week. Hopefully we won't be having to talk so much about tariffs. That'll settle down. I don't know if it'll settle down in a week, but...
I'm a big fan of land trust, huh?
All right. Well, let's talk about it. SP Futures up 76, Nasdaq Futures up 327. Go to quick break, and we'll have Audrey.
Yep. Take care.
Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now.
When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
No. No, man. No, man. I believe you get your ass kicked saying something like that, man.
Hello, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. Good song. Wow. That is the, tell me before I...
That's the Vogues.
The Vogues?
Yeah, 1966. Yeah.
I remember. I think all my guys had the albums. The albums. SP Futures up 84 days. I don't think they had too many hits, though.
Not too many, if I...
They were more than a one-hit wonder, but...
Yeah.
SP Futures up 85, Nasdaq Futures up 360. We're heading north here on this No stinking tariffs today type thing. Trump stocks popped 2% as Trump tariffs exemptions boost sentiment. Also didn't hurt that Trump people bought it Friday afternoon. I didn't say that, did it? DAX up 509, 2.5%. FTSE up 139, 1.7%. CAC round up 154, 2.1. So bullish all across Europe. Over in Asia, we've got the Hong Kong is leading the stack here. They're up 2%. Kind of surprising. Well, they seem to be more reflective. They're up 502, 2.4%. Shanghai is only up 24.6%. Nikkei up 396, 1.2. They were up more than that last night, but they've come back a little bit. Friday, we ran up in the afternoon. Dow up 619. S&P futures up 95. S&Ps were up 95. NASDAQ up 337. Like I said, so we're up, 170 points, 3.5% since this change in policy that nobody's supposed to know about, right? 10-year note down 6 basis points, 4.43. We've got oil coming back a little bit, up 93 cents, 62.43. And again, the spread between oil and RBOB is 203. RBOB was under, it was 198 when oil was 70. So something's weird on the refining side here. Gold down $14. Finally, it's on a down day. It's been up every single day. It's still 32.29. Silver was up 31 cents, 32.22. We've got foreign exchange, which has really been the story that nobody's talking about. Euro, 113.7. It's up from probably 108.8 3-4 weeks ago. So that's a 4% move. Massive move. Massive. Mm-hmm. British pound unchanged at 132. It was one. It hasn't moved as much. It was like 128.9. We've got Bitcoin up $1,000, 85,048. That what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Wednesday night, the Bulls play-in game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good morning, everyone. It's currently 7:37 a.m. on April 14th, 2025. Weather in Chicago, 57 degrees currently at Midway and 57 as well at O'Hare. High of today around 62, partly sunny and breezy. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 40 degrees with a slight chance of showers. Meanwhile, down in Phoenix, Arizona, we are at 71 degrees right now, warm with clouds giving way to sun, and a high of 94 degrees today. A far cry from us. Sports, we have the Cubs playing against Dodgers yesterday, and they won 4-2. This marks their 11th win this season compared to their 7 losses. The White Sox played the Red Sox as well and lost 3-15. The Masters Tournament, actually, no, I think that's 3-1. My bad. I have 3.5 here. Odd number. Well, anyway, the Masters Tournament took place yesterday with Rory McIlroy of Northern Ireland, an unofficial Irishman, coming out on top and winning $4,200,000. In second place, we have Justin Rose from England and Patrick Reed of the USA in third place. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
We have Audrey?
We do indeed, yeah.
Hey, Odd, how are you?
Good morning. What a beautiful day, huh?
Yeah. Hey, once in a while, you gotta give me a kudo. Odd and I went out Saturday night, and usual great time with her as your companion. It's always a good time. Plus, we run into some pretty interesting people at this Italian restaurant. We watched, and two guys I think were tied, or were one shot apart, was a McIlroy and who's the other guy? DeChambeau. And DeChambeau had cut he'd made this big putt on 18. So Audrey and I are sitting there having dinner, and all of a sudden he's on TV. Man, he's got the lights on at the practice range at Augusta. He's the only guy out there. He must have hit 100 balls while we were having dinner with the same club. Not liking that one, not liking that one. I'm going, Aud, he's not going to win tomorrow. What's he doing out there? Go have a beer, for God's sake. Sure enough, the next day he just pulled back. He wasn't even heard from. Like, what in God's name was he thinking about? Anyway, just me. Anyway, Aud, how are you?
You're a perfectionist.
He's doing something. I was
people who play at that level, that's all they think about is focusing, and it's muscle memory and that fraction of an inch. What was it, a $4 million payoff or something?
Oh, something like that, something like that, yeah. Well, Aud took us out to, our gang had breakfast, and Audrey was there, and Nancy was there, people on the show, and guys, we had three people that have been on the show at brunch, and it was a real nice time, and I always learn something when I talk to Di, Aud, and the first half hour of the show, all I did was talk about how many people my age have, and other people that never even cared, have forgotten all about these people in Vietnam. They got a thousand Agent Orange that are having chemotherapy every week. mean, it's not just not on the radar. Huh? I felt so bad to hear
no,
that.
People forget if it's not in front of their face about anything. But yeah, there's so many vets that, you know, people wonder what to do if they have free time. Go call up a VA home and go stop and visit people who nobody's had a visitor for years.
Yeah, what was the name of the guy who did the what do they call those guys that can play all the songs about everything? That he plays there once a month?
What the hell does that even mean? What did you just say?
We went to see the concert where they were raising money for the vet home, and the guy
played all the songs about everything. I got to remember that one.
Well, the guy knew about how many zillion songs. He was like a Ronnie Rice. What was the guy's name? We went to out west to see him that one night, and he said he played.
Okay. I know who you're talking about.
But yes. He said he went and played for the veterans home once a month. The guys came out and listened to the music and stuff. There's people that are really giving time for this, and I forget the guy's name. I'm not good at names, you know. But hey, what's going on in real estate? I was talking to John a little bit about land trust, and probably kick that up again next week. But what's going on by you, Nancy? Go ahead.
It's the spring season. It's in full swing. It's busy out here. It was a squirrel. Sorry. it is. It's the normal spring season. It's taking an uptick. Buyers are out. They're looking. Seems to be a little more availability in listings. Still tight. It's still tight overall throughout Chicago and the suburbs, from what I can see. Still more buyers than inventory out there. It's going to keep your prices up. There's been a little bit of a drop in the interest rates, so that got a flush of buyers out in the last couple of weeks. So have your mortgage broker monitor those rates when you're going out and about. There are things.
You've
got to watch that market for the rates because they're changing so much.
But how long we had that a couple of week ago blip where the 10-year went flying down to about maybe it was 4.1, and Nancy was saying she was on that week about how you had a few days there to lock in, I'm going to say 6.5, and then they raced right back up again the next week. So you really only had a couple of days. You got to be quick like a bunny if it goes down, don't you?
We'll sit there and watch the screen, and then when it looks like she's going to get the best deal, she'll call her client real quickly and ask him, say, okay, I want to lock this in, and lock it in at that moment. And sometimes, you know, you don't have very long. Just like making a trade, when they're moving this quickly, you know, you've got to take that rate and lock it in.
Well, what's the, I know this is more maybe a Nancy question than you, but obviously, you know, most of the stuff. What's the difference between me going and looking for a house and maybe wanting to buy it and locking in a rate for like a little bit? And what Kenny Pulcheri was talking about is he wanted to spend like a couple of months looking it up for a house, and he wanted to lock his rate in, so they charged him to lock the rate in. Is that something people do here, or is that a Florida thing?
You know, it doesn't seem to pay to matter that much now, unless you're getting, you know, if you got that sudden blip like we got about a week and a half ago, when there wasn't like almost a point difference, but they dropped from what it had been. But you do have to pay for it. It gets expensive. So that's why most people are just going to lock within the first week or so. You know, if it goes down, you know, you could always renegotiate it. But if it, you know, if you've got a nice low one and it blips up, then, you know, too bad for you. So it's always, you can always get that lower one, but you can't, you know, if it flips into the high range before you lock, then there's no going back.
If I wanted to lock it in for like 30 days, what are they going to charge me? $1,000, $500, $5,000?
No, and it's not for like, for a couple of weeks, it might be a couple hundred, $200 to $400.
Okay.
Again, that's probably more a Nancy question, depends on the loan. But there is a cost for it. And it's up on that day, it's going to cost. It's going to be extended for like a few days or something, but it will cost you.
How would your?
And I don't think we're at that point right now. So,
well, Audrey does, you know, all different price places, because some people sell something expensive and buy and go down, and some people go up. How does your world change when it's a, or Nancy's world? How does it change if it's a jumbo? If it's, you know, the place is $2 million. I mean, I know you'd love to have 10 of those this month, but how does the procedure change? I mean, there's the mortgage is different. It's not going to Fannie
and Freddie. The procedures are always the same. It's just usually it costs more to get a jumbo loan.
So where does Nancy go get one of those? She's not going to Fannie or Freddie to get that one. Who's going to hold that jumbo? How many places are still doing it?
Oh, well, everybody will do a mortgage. That's, you know, if somebody's qualified and they want $1 million mortgage, people are happy to give it to them.
So, but they sell it somewhere else.
Better that the buddy's there.
The bank doesn't necessarily hold it, right? They sell it somewhere else. No,
very few places hold your loan. It's sold before the ink's dry on the paper and you walk out the door.
Okay.
So very few places hold their own mortgage.
Was there a time when the jumbos were kind of hard to get? Where I seem to remember a couple of years and over the last 15 where you were saying it was hard to get a jumbo mortgage, but that's just once in a while?
Yeah, that has not been a problem for quite a while.
Okay, so you're saying business is little bit better.
You can qualify. Somebody's willing to give you the money. Let's put it that way.
Well, there you go. What's going on in the rental stuff? I know this is not the, you would not want to do 100 rentals a year, but you do some for people that, you know, friends and family pretty much. What's changed about that market? What's that all about?
I don't know what you mean. Sorry.
I'm saying, what's the rental market is, I know once in a while, I don't remember getting all this business, but you've mentioned a few times that the rental market's really hot. Is it the same thing.
It's tight. The rental market is even tighter than the housing market. So I've got a couple of people looking for rentals, and there's just nothing to be found, and it's very expensive. It's, you know, it's more to rent a condo or a townhouse right now than it is to buy it. And substantially more. So, you know, the rental market downtown in certain areas, it's very tight. So, you know, if you have to rent, you know, you're paying a lot to do it.
Well, what's the demographic? Is it people that get transferred into Chicago, think it might be a 2-year shtick, don't really want to buy something and just pay up for the rental and say, I might be out of here and I don't really want to be buying a place and getting a mortgage and then selling a place? And is it just people who don't think they're going to be in a spot for too long, or what?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, you've got, you know, your younger group of people who, you know, are just starting out, don't want, you know, maybe have their first place. They want to rent. They don't know where they're going to end up. They're just looking to have, be close to the action in the city and be able to go out and have a good time, so they're going to rent. Or, you know, a job transfer, or somebody who's just unsure about where they want to live. Life's going to change, and some people truly are just renters, and, you know, don't care if they put down the roots, or don't care if they have an established life. I'd like the flexibility of thinking that, you know, they can move someplace else if they want. So everybody's got a reason, but most people in the long run want to have some stability and buy something, because otherwise, I'm sorry, to me, you're just making somebody else rich.
Well, I think in today's world, on a theoretical level, I would debate that with Aud, but on a practical level, I think she's absolutely correct. And a lot of it has to do with, certainly since the year 2000, Aud, I think when, you know, the Fed has affected everybody to the extent where if you're not an owner of something, unless you buy a horrible house or the wrong stock, in the last 20 years, the people who have owned have done a lot better than the people who haven't. And that has to do with, you know, an inflation of asset prices. But it really wasn't always like that. Right? I mean, there were people I knew, you know, older people at the time, that say lived in New York. And in New York, people rented their apartment for like 40 years. Never really felt
because
like...
Because they had rent-controlled apartments.
Well, no, not even them. Just the asset push-up that I think the Fed has caused... You didn't see the value of the building double in 20 years to where your rent went up, you know, that much. Your rent went up a couple percent a year. And people were just happy, never owned a place. But that all changed, I'm going to say, probably in the 90s. I mean, in the last 25 years, unless you bought in the world's worst area where the place flooded or something, I think you were way ahead being an owner than a renter, weren't you? Don't you?
Oh, sure.
But I'm saying there were periods of time where there really wasn't, that you were just as well off taking your money and investing it somewhere else than you were in your house. It was like being on the trading floor. You and I were down there. Whether you leased a seat or owned a seat almost didn't make any difference. They decided there weren't going to be any traders anymore, only stockholders to charge people for quotes, and all of a sudden the people who were the owners made all the money, right? And the other guys are gone. But I mean, there probably will come a time where over a 10-year period the housing prices will stay steady, and maybe if you rented you didn't lose anything. You didn't gain anything, but you didn't lose anything either. So it's a right now, I think you're correct. In the last 20 years, it's pretty hard to defend renting. But by the same token, you've had a couple of odds clients where people that are moving, there's a lot of, what do you want to call it, hospitals putting up satellite centers in your area. And they're essentially stocking them with doctors, nurses, you know, whatever, that are moving to your area for the first time. And a lot of them are thinking, I don't know if this is a 2-year gig or a forever gig, and they seem to want to rent the first year, right? I don't think you can blame them for that, do you?
No, and if especially there's probably 4 or 5 major hospital centers that have been built around here now, and people have to live somewhere. Most people don't want to drive too far to go to work, so you're kind of stuck within the housing market, and you've got to live someplace quickly. Again, it's a problem of finding something, but yeah, they will come in. Maybe they're new to an area, got transferred from out of state, don't know where they want to live. People will test it out with the rental area, and then take that 6 months or a year to decide where they want to put down roots if they're going to stay here.
Well, what's the status of, I know you've never mentioned it, doesn't mean it doesn't ever happen, what's the status of subletting? I mean, guy moves in with his lovely bride and her doctors and nurses, and they're going to rent for a while, and all of a sudden after 6 months they go, hey, this Orleans the place for me, I love the area, by the way, you know, maybe somebody's going to have a baby or whatever, and then they call you up and say, well, we got 6 months to go on our lease, and by the way, we want a house.
Don't call me with your problem, argue with the landlord. Most landlords don't want to do that. I've never had anybody do that. Again, I don't handle a ton of rentals, but it depends what's in your lease. Some landlords allow things to be, reletted, subletted. Others do not. But, you know, that's a gamble for a landlord that you're going to get a good tenant in there. So that's tough on everybody because the person who's in there has got to find a qualified candidate that's going to be acceptable to the landlord. So that is something you really don't want to get yourself into a situation if you don't have to.
Well, plus if you start looking 6 months in, by the time you find them a nice place and everybody gets, the whole thing gets straightened out, it might be another few months, so it's not, a year isn't that long, pretty much.
I don't know. That's something, don't deal with it. I don't think you see a lot of. I really don't. I think that's a bit much rarer than it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see that much in the city either like that. So what's hot? I mean, I know you've had a you always have people because people like to use Laud more than once or twice because she does a nice job. What's the hottest thing going right now? Are you doing listings people? Are you doing buyers? What do you have?
Well, there's both sides going on. You know, it's like there's a buy and a sell going on. You know, people are, again, as we talked about, it's still a seller's market. You know, very much slanted, still not low inventory. It's going to be another busy, I think it's going to be another busy spring and summer. It looks shaping up like it, that there'll be tough competition. There's multiple offers already on price range all the way across from low to high. So again, if you're thinking about getting your house ready to sell, make sure it's in the best shape you can. Make sure your exterior looks good. Make the curb appeal look good. Clean up the dead leaves. Rake everything up, give it a fresh face so you need good curb appeal. And then inside, you don't have to do a complete overhaul, but at the very least, maybe you think about having your house professionally cleaned, get it painted, anything that's worn out, replace if you can. So you don't have to spend a fortune if you're trying to prep it to sell, but at least make it neat and clean. Paint works wonders. Little decorative touches will work, but make it very appealing. You want your buyer to come in, look around, and say, yeah, I could visualize myself living here. So you always have, you know, hey, but there's realtors can help you with that, stagers, I'm a stager myself, have somebody come in, and we all, none of us can look at anything we have our, objectively, our kids, our pets, our houses. We always think we have the best house in the world and it's perfect. You, if you're thinking about selling, have an objective person come in, your realtor, maybe a neighbor or a friend, but they might not tell you the truth so they don't hurt your feelings. But have somebody come in and people will say, wow, I never thought about that. You're right, that doesn't look good there. Or maybe I should not have the sofa in front of the window. So there's certain things, move the furniture around, you know, make it clean, get rid of any, you know, pet odors in the house. We all love our dogs, but it should not smell like wet dogs or have a cat hair plastered to the sofa. So
yeah,
just gotta make it as pretty and neat and clean as you can. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but you do have to look at it with an eye to what the average buyer is looking for.
When you guys, I mean, I've watched, again, I never get involved, so the next station needs me screwing up her stuff. You guys have sold houses for people, some of whom it looked like there was going to take them, you know, 48 dumpsters and stuff to clear the crap out of the place, and yet somehow you've managed to deal with this on all different levels. People that have had, you know, houses that are perfect, people that are, you can't walk through the garage because there's, you know, so much crap in there, not to mention the rest of the house. You've managed to deal with it. Who are the people that are the customers of, like, these places? Whatever it is, we'll take your house as is, leave all your crap, leave everything, just walk away. Who are their clients? Divorce things or people dying or what?
They're either, they're usually younger and energetic people who can look at that and say, wow, I can gut this in a couple of
weekends. No, I'm talking about the companies that advertise constantly.
Lot of those are rip-off people. I tell people to stay as far away from those as possible. You're not going to get... Those places will give you cash for your house. They'll give you cash at their price. And a lot of times people will not even look around. If you're going to do that, you can get a price from them, but don't sign on the dotted line until you maybe get a couple of estimates from different sources, different realtors, and get a market analysis. What is your house worth? Because I had a client of mine who called, and she lived out of state. Her dad died. He lived here. She asked me to come over and look at the house. I had sold her house years ago. And said, well, this guy whose company offered me X. And I said, well, that is probably $80,000 to $120,000 less than you should get. And she was floored. She had no idea the market. So they get people who have no idea what their house is truly worth. So, or some people are in a hurry, but take the time to get two or three estimates from different professionals before you do that.
Well, if you've got two kids.
Believe me, those people make money in that business for a reason.
I think, you know, it's the two kids that don't like
you. It's people, you know, they're looking for a bargain. So, you know, they're only willing to give you so much because they're going to give you the money that they think it's worth with their eye to renovating it so they could flip it, buy it them, you know, and turn it. Most of those are just flipping companies, you know, where they're going to buy it, sell it, fix it up, sell it to somebody else. So just be aware that you're selling it for a fair price. Well, so you have to do your due diligence.
We were talking earlier in the show about Di and all the stuff she's doing over at the Veterans. So, do you sell a lot of homes? The VA mortgages, are they still something people get?
They're, you know what? I have not done one for a while. It's just not come up. But you know, I think a lot of veterans aren't aware of that they should use that resource. And you know, the spouses of veterans, you know, there's a lot of benefits open to the people who served our country and also to their families. And people should be aware of it. I mean, it's not as big a deal paperwork as people think. You get your VA certificate, people will help you file for that and use that. Use that with no money down.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people don't really.
Thing to do.
It was part of the GI Bill. It was mortgages, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, is there a time limit on that? If you know, like, you know, Kathy's...
Yeah, and you can use it multiple times. It's
okay,
not like
that's what I'm asking. So I know, like, I know Kathy's nephew served in Afghanistan. Now, can he... You've already answered the question, but I was going to ask, does he get, like, 5 years to use that, or can he use it when he's 80? Or can he
you're a veteran and you served. You just get your...
Well, then why would anybody not use it?
Pardon me?
Why would anybody not use it? They only just don't know?
I think people don't, you know, they just don't think about it, or, you know, if they've got a down payment. But for the person who doesn't have money for a down payment, you know, it's a no money down service to our veterans.
Wow.
And I encourage all of them to apply for it and use it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, something good to know, as usual, Ed. Well, I'll be talking to you. Thank you very much for the stuff. By the way, the brunch was great. I was telling everybody, we talked the first half hour about what Di's doing at the VA stuff, and pretty amazing stuff, huh? I mean, what volunteer people.
She's an amazing person.
Yeah.
Diane's an amazing person. So if you're looking to donate to a worthy cause, Diane Kelly Thompson at Fisher House. Takes care of your veterans' families who come in and stay, kind of like Ronald McDonald House. You're looking for a great, worthy place to make a donation, make yourself feel better. Fisher House is certainly that. So there's a plug for Diane's.
Well, you know, she I'm gonna have her back on again because she actually I think she got some people. I don't know how many from the show to pony up some money for the.
Yes,
place
she did, and it was wonderful, and she was very, very grateful. And also visit a vet in the home.
Yeah.
Everybody with somebody people who. Are in the VA homes in Hines. Pick a spot. Diane is throwing an Easter party for some vets out of her own pocket at the home so that they have an Easter dinner this Sunday. So if anybody has free time to volunteer, it's a great place to just drop in and say hi. You go a long way.
I was talking about what a hit your Rosie was out at the Bantino home the day we went out to see Walt.
Oh, yes, she was.
All those guys that
yes, she's a a big star.
I'm saying those guys came out of their literally almost a coma when they saw the dog. When they saw a dog, it was really something to see. Anyway, SP Futures up 90.
It's great therapy. You know, you have a therapy dog. Take them to a VA home, a nursing home for that fact. People need company. A lot of times, these people have been there for 5, 10, 20, 30 years, and a lot of them never get visitors. So, if you have nothing to do with your time, go make somebody else's day better.
SP Futures up 91. Good thought, Odd. NASDAQ Futures, well, if you're belong, you're having a good day. NASDAQ Futures up 390. We'll see if that holds. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTIsecurities.com. JetBlue Airways. It's not the only way to fly, but it should be. Visit JetBlue.com. Empower HR, your human resources partner. That's EmpowerHR.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. BDL Compliance Consulting. Visit bdlcc.com. DAX Research. Listen to David Andelman on Mondays and Thursdays and go to dacsresearch.net.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.